Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. It's the second hour of the show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for this program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frayne, is at the controls. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about Burma and something about its history, concentrating on its modern history. And our guest for the program is the author of a new book, which is in part history and is also in part family memoir. The book is titled The River of Lost Footsteps, Histories of Burma. Farrar Straus Giroux is the publisher. And the author is our guest, Tant Myintu. He was born here in the United States in 1966. He was born in New York of Burmese parents. He was born here where his grandfather, U Thant, was the Secretary General of the United Nations. He was educated at Harvard and Cambridge. He was a fellow of Trinity College, Cambridge, from 1995 until 1999. He's also served on United Nations peacekeeping operations in Cambodia and Bosnia. More recently, he was head of policy planning in the UN's Department of Political Affairs. Right at the moment, he is a visiting senior fellow at the International Peace Academy in New York and a research associate of the Cambridge Center for History and Economics. Also this year, he'll be a visiting fellow at Harvard's South Asia Initiative. As we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The number, if you'd like to call in, be a part of the conversation, 333-9455. That's for Champaign Urbana listeners. We do also have a toll-free line, and if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number and we'll pay for the call. The call will be on us. That's 800-222-9455. So again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Dr. Thant, hello.
Hello.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, we certainly appreciate it. I think that probably for a lot of people, they will know virtually nothing about Burma. And I think that part of your reason, I expect, for wanting to write this book is indeed to try to give some people some basic understanding of the country and its history, and particularly what has happened in Burma, say, since World War II, or perhaps since the since slightly before World War II. Start us out here and talk a little bit about Burma and what are the basic things that you would like people to know?
I think to the extent that people know anything about Burma, they might have a sense that there is a repressive military regime in power, and they may have heard about Aung San Suu Kyi, who won the Nobel Peace Prize in the early 1990s, has been campaigning for democracy since 1988. But people probably aren't aware at all of Burma's very sort of rich and colorful history. I think it's important to know that Burma was a kingdom for over 1,000 years, more or less with very similar borders to today, that Burma fell to the British Empire in the late 19th century and was part of British India and under colonial rule for the better part of 100 years, achieved independence in the late 1940s, but only after the Japanese had invaded the country in 1941 and 42 and occupied the country, and only after World War II had virtually destroyed Burma's economy and killed many hundreds of thousands of people in the early 1940s. I think the most important thing to know in trying to understand Burma today are really three things. The first, that ever since independence from Britain in 1948, Burma has been at civil war. It's been at relative peace over the last few years, but this is the longest-running series of armed conflicts anywhere in the world. The second, that Burma's had a military dictatorship since 1962. It's not a new thing. It's actually a more than 40-year-old military dictatorship. And lastly, Burma, which at some points in its history had been a relatively rich country, is today one of the poorest countries in the world. So it's a very complex set of problems today that the international community is facing in Burma.
I think it seems to be very clear that you're thinking that that the shape of modern Burma, and I don't mean that geographically, I guess I mean that in a kind of a psychological sense, has a lot to do, was determined in large part by this experience of the involvement of Britain. First, as you say, in the became part of British India in the, say, the mid-1880s, and then later was a crown colony of Britain, that the feeling of the Burmese people that it was a distinct nation, had been a military power in the region, had at one time actually even successfully fought a war with China, which would have been no small thing, and that so much of that with the British was swept away first when it wasn't even a country on its own. It was annexed and made part of India, then was later made a colony. Do you think that somehow that colonial experience is something from which Burma has never quite recovered?
Absolutely. I think it's true in some other parts of the world or some other countries as well. But, you know, you have many countries which are very much products of colonial rule in the sense that they were carved out of territories which may have belonged to other nations or are carved together involving different tribes or different nationalities. But Burma was very much its own country for a long time. And as you said, Burma, just before the British appeared on the scene, was an expansive military power of its own, sort of fighting not just the Chinese, but conquering what is today Thailand and Laos and even parts of northeastern India. And what this had done, for better or for worse, was instill in the Burmese a very early sense of nationalism and a sort of pride in military conquest. And when the British, over a series of three wars, Anglo-Burmese wars in the 19th century, conquered the Burmese, this was something that was very difficult for Burmese nationalist sentiment to take. It was a very traumatic experience to go from being a conquering empire of its own to becoming dominated by British India. And not only was Burma conquered by the British, but the British, unlike many other parts of their Asian possessions, decided to to abolish the Burmese monarchy and basically overturned all the institutions, the social, political institutions that had held the country together for such a long time and evolved over a certain century. So it was a double thing, both psychologically in terms of the pride of at least some in Burma and how they saw themselves as this conquering race, but also institutionally in that the British removed in the late 19th century, somewhat unwittingly, the key institutions, the monarchy and the nobility, the aristocracy, that had held the country together for such a long time.
Mm. Japan occupied the country in the early 40s. At one point, some of the Burmese actually fought with the Japanese. They later fought with the British to drive out the Japanese. After the Japanese were gone, it was shortly after, not very long after, that Burma became independent. And yet it seemed right from that point, maybe even before independence, there was a great deal of struggle for power within various rival elements within the country, that is, Burmese against Burmese, and that one wonders if things hadn't gone a little bit differently in 1947, 1948, whether Burma would be the place that it is now.
Absolutely. I mean, there are two kind of very, very violent bookends to British rule in Burma. The first is what we had just talked about before in the late 19th century when the British took over the kingdom and destroyed the institutions that were there. And then in 1941, the Japanese invaded the country at the end of 41, around the time of Pearl Harbor, in huge numbers. And this was the longest British retreat in British history when the British military presence in Burma retreated in a very bloody campaign that the Japanese waged in 41 and 42. And it destroyed the whole infrastructure of the country. And there was a very small radical group of very young men at the time who had snuck away to Japan and who had trained under the Japanese and who formed basically a small Burmese army for the first time in 100 years that was going to fight alongside the Japanese and did fight alongside the Japanese and became collaborators under the Japanese occupation. But by 1945, or probably late 1944, they saw the writing on the wall in terms of what was happening globally in World War II and decided that the prudent thing for them would be to switch sides, and they did. And the leader of this militant group of nationalists, General Aung San, is the father, actually, of Aung San Suu Kyi, the pro-democracy campaigner today. And so when the British reappeared on the scene at the end of World War II in 1945 and 1946, they found not sort of a passive country, but they found an armed country with this partisan force, like in Yugoslavia, like in many parts of Europe, which were then demanding independence. I mean, they had fought with the Japanese, turned against the Japanese, and now they wanted to be seen as an allied power in their own right, and deserving of immediate independence from Britain. And the tragedy of Burmese history, in a way, is that the British at that time had wanted a long reconstruction period and a gradual transfer of rule. But in the end, they didn't really care very much about Burma. They were very much focused on what was going on in India at that time between the Congress Party and the Muslim League. They were very much focused on Palestine at the time. They were very much focused on problems in London, which had been devastated by, and the British economy, which had been devastated by war. So in the end, they just quit Burma. They just quit Burma, and they decided to quit Burma in 46, 47, and handed over power to this group of quite militant nationalists. But as you say, there were many others in Burma who had different ideas. There was already a very active communist political organization, and eventually, within a year or two, there were also many ethnic groups in the country who wanted either autonomy or straight-out independence from this new Burma. And so within a few months of the British leaving, the country fell apart into these rival and contesting military groups.
Yeah. And one of the things that happened here in the late 40s was the man you talk about, General Aung San, who is the father of Aung San Suu Kyi, was assassinated. One wonders if that had not happened, would things be different? But then given the great potential for instability and infighting, maybe it wouldn't have made very much difference.
It's hard to say. I mean, on the one hand, he was someone who collaborated with the Japanese. On the other hand, he was a very young man at the time. He was in his late 20s. And there's a lot to suggest that if he had lived on, he would have been not only a great supporter of Burma becoming a stable democracy, but he would have been the strong hand that would have been able to see that through and forge a coalition of the different ethnic groups and different political elements in the country and have averted a civil war. But having said that, there's also signs that, you know, the communists in the country would have opposed him as well. And even though Burma's armed conflict in more recent times has been basically an ethnic conflict, in the beginning it was very much the main contest was between the Burmese government, which was left-leaning but not communist, and the communist insurgents, which overran many of the key cities in 1949 and 1950. So it's very difficult to say, but I think the double colonial legacy of this sort of wounded nationalist pride that wanted to be reasserted, but also the lack of stable institutions in the country, was something that meant that Burma became independent under very difficult conditions in 1948.
Let me introduce quickly our guest for this hour of Focus 580, Thant Minh Tu. He is the author of the new book, The River of Lost Footsteps, Histories of Burma. It's published by Farrar Straus Giroux. It's out there in the bookstores now. And we're talking about Burma and its modern history, what has been happening there in recent years. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. One of the things that you said right up front was about the three very basic things people need to know. One of them, the fact that it has been ruled by, Burma has been ruled by a military dictatorship for a long time now, ever since 1962, when there was a coup led by Ne Win. I believe that when you were growing up, certainly and living in New York, and your grandfather, your mother's father, was the Secretary General of the United Nations, certainly there would have been people representing his government there in your home. Tell us about Ne Win and about what things were like in the 60s. And did that pose some particular challenges for Burmese who were living in the United States and who were essentially representing, in one way or another, representing that government?
In many ways, even more than Aung San, who we had mentioned before, it's General Ne Win who's shaped the history of Burma over the last the second half of the 20th century. He was one of these militant nationalists who had been trained by the Japanese, but he's also one of the ones who switched sides at the end. And in 1948, at independence or soon after independence, he wound up as the head of the Burmese army. And this was at a time of civil war when the Burmese army was very, very small, almost overwhelmed by all these different communist and ethnic insurgent groups. And it was General Ne Win and the other very young men around him, I think he was in his mid-30s at the time, who slowly built up this military machine under what was in the 1950s a democratically elected government. My grandfather had worked for that democratically elected government. But it was being faced with all these different armed opponents, some of whom, like the Chinese nationalists, had been supported by the CIA in the what would be the Golden Triangle. Some would later be supported by the Communist Chinese. Some would be later supported by the Thai government in Bangkok. So they were facing all these foreign-supported insurgents. And they slowly but surely built up this big and quite professional and quite tough military machine. And everyone assumed, or some people assumed for a while, that this would always be loyal to the democratic government, but eventually they became both confident enough, but they also became, they also started to feel that they could do better than the civilian politicians in winning the civil war and doing what was best for the country. So in 1962, General Ne Win led this coup, which overthrew the democratic government and began what's been now almost 60 years of dictatorship. This wasn't a strange thing at the time, because in Asia in the early 1960s was full of military dictatorships. Pakistan, Thailand, South Korea, Indonesia, many of these countries were under military rule or would soon be. So that wasn't strange. But what was very strange in terms of what Ne Win did was he essentially cut off Burma from the whole rest of the world in terms of trade, in terms of investment, in terms of tourism, in terms of aid and assistance. He really shut off the country from the rest of the world. And that my grandfather, if he had been living in Burma at the time, would probably have been arrested with other senior political figures in the old democratic government. But he had just been elected UN Secretary General, and so he and my parents were living in New York at the time. But he maintained fairly cordial relations with General Ne Win, who he's never close to, but you know, he knew. And it was only towards the end of his Secretary Generalship that they had more of a falling out in the late 1960s and early 1970s.
You said another of the things, sort of these three things that people need to know about Burma, is that it's today it is the country and most of the people are really very poor. And I think that a lot of people would say that it needn't be, that it perhaps shouldn't be, because it's a country that certainly has rich natural resources. And I think that a lot of people would lay the country's economic difficulties at the feet of Ne Win and his odd political economic ideas.
Absolutely, it was a disaster. I mean, on the one hand, though, it's important to remember that it wasn't as if Burma was a rich and prosperous and thriving country in the 1950s either. It had been the farmers had been incredibly impoverished by the Great Depression in the 30s. The country, as I mentioned before, had been destroyed by World War II. It had undergone this huge civil war, so it was already in bad shape compared to many other countries in the region. But the policies of Ne Win, which were essentially statist, sort of socialist policies of nationalizing major industry, but also, again, cutting off Burma from the international economy, were disastrous. And even worse was his complete lack of attention to education in the country, to proper health care in the country. And unlike, say, South Korea, or unlike even Suharto in Indonesia, he did not trust civilians. He didn't trust educated civilian technocrats, economists. He had military men make all these decisions for the economy. And so where South Korea, for example, which was just as poor as Burma in the 1950s, has become this industrial, you know, sort of success over 30, 40 years, because they relied, even under the military dictators, on properly trained economists, the Burmese have just gone from bad to worse. And very much so, the current impoverishment of the country is because of the policies that began in many ways, the policies that began in 1962.
Let me ask you just one further quick question, and then I have a caller here, and other people certainly are welcome in. And this, in a sense, jumps us right to where we are now. You were talking about the fact that one of the things that Ne Win did was, in a sense, he really cut the country off, cut Burma off from the rest of the world. And that so in a sense now, it's ironic that for those people like the United States and for those others who would like to see democratic reform in Burma, that their method is to further isolate the country and to impose sanctions and to indeed keep it, in a sense, closed off. And I think your argument really has been that that's the wrong way to, if you're interested in reform, democratic reform in Burma, that this isn't the way to do it.
No, that I disagree with sanctions completely. I think sanctions in some cases, maybe even in the Burma case, could be useful as a threat to some extent. It could be useful on a specific tactical issue to try to pressure the government to make a specific change, not just in the Burma case, but in general. But as a way of trying to cope with the entire crisis in Burma, the fact that there is this long-term military government that's always been shy of the outside world, that there is this long-running armed conflict, that there is this impoverishment of the country, to say that somehow cutting Burma off, and it's not total sanctions, it's cutting off Burma from Western trade and investment and interaction, will somehow help to lay the foundations for democratic change, I think is counterintuitive. I think if complete sanctions, a complete cutoff of the country could be imposed for a month or something as a threat that involved China and India and other neighbors as well, maybe that would have a chance. But even that, I think, is unlikely, and it'll never happen, because the idea that China would impose sanctions on Burma to make it a democracy, I think, is ridiculous. So when we talk about sanctions, we're basically talking about the West cutting off or lessening its interactions with Burma, and I think that's exactly the wrong way to go.
All right, let's talk with a caller here in Champaign County, here where we are, and it's line one. Hello.
Hi, good morning. Mm-hmm. I had a question about what people may know about Burma is this idea of the slave-built pipeline. But you said something about South Korea that I can't leave uncommented on, which is that properly trained economists would have told them to cooperate with the IMF. They didn't. They consequently did prosper better when they did involve in the IMF. We had the Asian currency crash. So there are a lot of things that are said, without examination that need to be examined. So I don't know that just in the process of talking on a talk show, it's hard to unpack all of those things at once. But anyway, putting that aside, the pipeline that we heard about, if people were watching the human rights situation and the slavery that built it, the offshore part of it was contracted to Halliburton through Unocal. Unocal has been recalcitrant amongst others. I don't know if they've actually got a shell, no pun intended, to isolate themselves from the Burma economy. And I take your point. China is really just pillaging the place, fire sale prices for the tropical hardwoods and et cetera, and probably a lot of the gems. There's a little going on about blood diamonds. I don't know if the blood gems story from Burma is something you mentioned. It's impossible to isolate, but it seems to me with the pipeline deal, and I don't know what status it is now, my memory is that the sale to China of holdings was involved in the Burma archipelago, but I haven't been able to actually Google anything that confirms that. What I'm getting at is while there's talk of sanctions, there's still a lot of economic deals that had been hatched. They may be stalled, they may not. But I wanted you to comment on.
Sure, thank you. I think there are a couple of things. First, it's important to get the actual. I mean, sanctions is a very broad term, and I've used it slightly broadly. But there are a few things. One is that the U.S. and many other Western countries cut off assistance to Burma in the late 1980s after the democracy uprising was crushed in 1988, and have been opposing to varying extents increased multilateral assistance through the World Bank or anybody else to the country. Second, there have been lots of boycott campaigns which have fairly successfully led to many Western companies pulling out voluntarily from Burma from the early mid-1990s onwards. But then there's a very specific sanctions law in the United States which now prohibits any new investment in the country. It doesn't exempt existing investment, and that means that one U.S. oil company, Unocal, is still present in the country. One thing that has changed in the Burmese economic picture is that over the last 10 years or so, Burma has discovered an enormous amount of hundreds of billions of dollars potentially worth of natural gas. And countries in the region, China, India, Thailand, South Korea to some extent in particular, have been very keen to access that natural gas and be part of new investments to develop that natural gas. Now, in terms of sanctions and the politics and the ethics around it. I'm not saying that every investment in the country is good, or every trade interaction or every tourist visit or any other kind of aid or investment is necessarily a good thing. I think there should be ethical trade, ethical tourism, ethical investment, and there could be a proper discussion of guidelines on that. I just think that in general, the idea that by the West in some way distancing themselves economically, socially, culturally, in other ways from the country at a time when other countries in the region, China in particular, are extremely eager to move in and engage, is not really a strategy for promoting the kinds of political change that I think we would all like to see in the country. I think also that sanctions, in a way, are a way of trying to pressure or persuade this military regime to mend its ways and to move towards democracy. And I think any strategy that's based on this group of generals actually changing their mind about the way in which they govern the country is not likely to succeed. I think where we have an opening is that the military, this current generation of military leaders since the early 1990s have said they want to move towards a free market economy. And I think that does provide an opening for much greater involvement and interaction, which I think quite quickly over a 10 or 15 year period will open up many more doors of political opportunity. It's not a great solution, but I think going down this current path of simply trying to divest from the country and cut off the links that still remain with the West to the country is not going to bear fruit anytime soon.
Well, generals saying they're in favor of the free market, you know, Pinochet said that, and used repression against unionists, et cetera, to introduce Milton Friedman's free market. So I think it can be a cover, and usually is a cover for a lot of things, and including probably the generals getting the main share of the pie.
No, it's very possible. I think it's very possible that, I mean, it's very possible that, I mean, the general certainly will, or the government certainly will try to tax it. There'll be corruption. But I think, you know, if you go, and I travel to Burma still, and I go there once or twice a year, and I've traveled around a lot the last several years. I mean, there are businesses, Western businesses or European businesses in the country, which do work with a local Burmese businessman, which do create employment, which is maybe taxed by the government, but in general is fairly independent of the government. And it's these connections that I would like to see more of, because I can see in these towns where they have these businesses, there's a slow erosion, but a real erosion of the extent to which the military has a grip on local society. It's not like North Korea where, you know, the army controls everything. The army is very repressive. If you stand up and criticize them, if you ask for democracy, they'll probably lock you up and put you in jail for a couple of years. But it, you know, there's 90% of Burmese society and economy which actually happens free of the military, because in a way they're not competent enough or have the institutional capacity to control the whole society in that way. And I would want a more clever or creative strategy to exploit those gaps and to use not just business, but people visiting and NGOs and other things to try to strengthen Burmese civil society and the private sector more generally. I think that's, in a way, that will lay the foundations, at least, for change more than the current thing of simply trying to leave and hoping for the best.
Well, what would be the best strategy to actually have some opening, even at the local level, for the democratic movement? I mean, this group is a little more subtle than the Slork, but they still have to lock up Aung San Suu Kyi when there's a meeting somewhere, right?
So, yeah.
I mean, what it's a frustrating circumstance, but I just had to make the point about Halliburton being involved, because the corporations, you know, you can talk about low-level openings to free trade, but when the big deals and natural gas deal is cut, you know who's going to be feeding at the trough. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, other comments and questions are certainly welcome. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Thant Mien Thu, is the author of a recently published book, The River of Lost Footsteps, Histories of Burma. That's the title. It's published by Farrar, Straus, Giroux. He was born of Burmese parents in New York in 1966, where his grandfather, U Thant, was the Secretary General of the United Nations. He was educated at Harvard and Cambridge, was a fellow of Trinity College. He served on United Nations peacekeeping operations in Cambodia and Bosnia. More recently, was head of policy planning in the UN's Department of Political Affairs. He's a visiting senior fellow at the International Peace Academy in New York and a research associate of the Cambridge Center for History and Economics, and also this year will be a visiting fellow at Harvard's South Asia Initiative. Questions welcome 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Tell us about what happened in 1988.
By 1988, the military had already been in power for about a quarter of a century. The economy was in very poor shape at the time. Inflation was rising quite fast. There's a lot of dissatisfaction. And this dissatisfaction had spilled over into a few protests by late 1987 and early 1988 by students mainly at the universities in Rangoon. But the huge sort of momentum for this was built up when General Ne Win himself, who was then already quite old, spoke to a meeting of his party faithful, and basically himself suggested that they should consider a return to a multi-party, meaning a democratic system of government. And this suddenly inspired the people on the street, who thought that they, for the first time in a long time, had this opening and had this opportunity. And the protests, which had been attracting a few thousand people, grew into tens of thousands of people in Rangoon, and then hundreds of thousands of people in Rangoon, all of whom were marching, demanding an end to military government, and using the slogan, democracy, meaning, I think, more just a change and a break from the past as much as democracy itself. But this led then to a very bloody attempted crackdown first in the beginning of August. But when, despite killing dozens of people, people still took to the streets, the army backed down for several weeks. And what you had in Burma was this amazing sort of situation, a bit like the Prague Spring in the 1960s, where groups of students and workers and Buddhist monks and others took over a lot of administration in some of the cities, where civil administration, the normal civil administration, collapsed entirely, the military set up administration. And you had almost a successful revolution against the government. But then General Ne Win's army moved back in again in September of that year, after about a few weeks, and used lethal force, killing dozens, if not hundreds of people, to reestablish their authority on September 18th, I think, in 1988. And that was the end. But the military itself was very shaken by this experience, and they initially promised that they were just restoring order and that they would see through this transition to democracy as promised. And they promised elections, and they allowed political parties to emerge. And Aung San Suu Kyi was the head of one of these political parties that were set up at that time. They did hold elections in 1990, but then they had second thoughts, and they decided that rather than handing over power immediately to the party that had won the elections, Aung San Suu Kyi's party, that they would do it in the most drawn-out way possible. And this process of drawing up a new constitution has taken all this time, since 1980 to 2006, and they're only just about to finish it now. But what's important to point out is that whereas that story, to some extent, is known on the outside, I think what's not appreciated on the outside is that a parallel story in Burma, which is that in 1989, completely independent of all this, the Burma Communist Party, which had been fighting the government for 50 years, imploded in the jungle. They had 25,000 well-armed fighters, and they collapsed through an internal mutiny. And the Burmese army was able then to arrange ceasefire deals with the militia successor groups of this old communist army, and then to pressure all these many of the remaining ethnic insurgent groups to also agree to ceasefires. So what happened in the early 1990s around this time was that the Burmese army, after 50 years of fighting, was on the verge of winning the civil war. And I think that explains to some extent their reluctance to hand over power to civilians, because they felt from their own history that they were just on the verge of winning this historic victory over their battlefield enemies after 50 years.
Hmm. You, in 1988, you spent some time there. What was it like?
I was there. I was actually there just before the uprising in most of 87 and early 88, when the first protests were starting. And the people who were starting the protests were very much people of my generation. I was 21, 22 at the time, and so were they. So I feel I have a sense of the frustration they felt, and then also the short period of optimism they felt that things could change. This was a time when Marcos had just fallen in the Philippines, and just before Tiananmen and the fall of the Berlin Wall. But there was a sense that history was finally on the side of positive political change. in the country. After the uprising was crushed, I spent many months on the Thai-Burma border because thousands of students, Burmese university students and others, had fled to the border, not just to flee, but in their hope to kind of regroup and perhaps arm themselves in a new insurgency against the Burmese government.
Hmm. We will have another caller here, someone to talk with. Let's do that. The caller's in Charleston on our toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, good program, David. A very articulate young man here. And I have two questions. I would like to hear what your guest has to what his interpretation of democracy is. And secondly, what he thinks of democracy is, what he thinks democracy is in the United States.
Yeah, the second one is a bit difficult. I think it's a good question because I think when I say democracy in the Burma context, many people use the word democracy simply to mean something different from military rule, an end to military rule, a civilian government that's elected in some way, but without really thinking through what other kinds of freedoms there need to be, without really thinking through what sort of free press there needs to be, what other institutions there need to be. I mean, in my mind, for me, what's even in some ways more important than simply having an elected government is Burma moving towards a much more liberal system of government in the sense that there are freedoms to speak your mind, to have a free press, because Burma has been such an ethnically divisive, divided society. And I think without that dialogue and without that freedom to have a much more mature and creative political debate, simply having an elected government will mean very little. You could have a populist, sort of ethnic nationalist government, which then suppresses the minorities, who are about 35% of the population. But I think so. You know, and that I think links to my analysis and my suggestion that it's important to, if not to engage with the government, but to invest in Burmese society and to try to further open it up using whatever openings there might be, to try to connect Burma again with global debates and ideas on a whole range of issues. Because if all the pressure is about, you know, having elections, it's possible that, you know, tomorrow we'll wake up and one general will say we'll have elections and you have an elected government. But then so what? I mean, the army will still be there lurking in the background, able to take power again at any time. And it could still be a very illiberal society.
Yes.
So I think we need a broader kind of strategy of how to help Burmese civil society and others kind of grow at this time. Your question about what do I think about democracy in America? I mean, I've lived in Europe as well, and I've and I know to some extent some of the newer democracies in Asia, and I know that, you know, it works differently in different countries. In some countries, you have a much more mature and informed citizenship and debate and parliament, and in other countries, much less. I think in the United States, in some places locally, you have very good debates to some extent on some national issues. But, you know, it goes up and down. But I think what's important in all of these countries and what's completely missing in Burma is you have underneath basic civil rights that are generally met both here and in Europe in a way that's, you know, light years ahead of what exists in Burma today.
Can I have a last comment, David?
Yeah, sure.
I'm sure your guest understands and his articulation about democracy in the U.S. It appears to me that this last election, the midterm, when the Democrats have achieved a majority again, that we are then hopeful that the Democratic ideal can be relieved of its what has been a dictatorship of a narrow majority, which, you know, that happened here. We are so-called civilized, and we don't have the army in the streets and the conditions under which, you know, the folks in Burma or other parts of the world live. But the dictatorship of a slim majority is hardly democracy. And if somehow it can be healed, and the U.S. But on top of that, I do have to say that when dictatorship leaves of any sort, or militarism leaves, and somehow that capitalism is going to fill the bill, is, I think, an utter failure. Because the capitalism, my understanding, is manipulated by a few recently on a show that I have very low opinion of. Oprah Winfrey had this Robert Rauscher, or he was Bill Clinton's Secretary of Labor, blipped on the screen. 40% of the wealth in the U.S. is owned by 1% of the population. And how democratic is that? And how is access and all the other things and the trickle-down ideas of Ronald Reagan and such as that? So I had to say that because it is stark. And what your guest is saying about the conditions in Burma, how they have been troubled by U.S. foreign policy and others, and even the British colonialism, which is a horrendous. You know, we didn't have time to go to places like Burma in the 1850s because we were annihilating the Indians here. And that, you know, when that was all over with, then, and the Spanish, then somehow we become, get to the Philippines and a bunch of other places, you know, where the horrors were extended there. So if your guest has any comment, I'll hang up and listen. And
yeah.
Again, David, bye.
Thank you. I mean, I'll make a related point, which is also connects back to a point made by an earlier caller about, you know, is it right to kind of just trust Western businesses going in and doing the right thing, which is that, you know, if you look at a map of Burma, Burma is essentially a very small country. It's 55 million people, but it's still a relatively very small country next to two enormous countries of India and China, over a billion people each and growing. And in a way, Burma's future is already determined. Burma is going to be at the crossroads of India and China and at the crossroads of two of the most of the biggest and most dynamic economies and societies in the world. And both these countries, India and China, will be trading and investing and be part of Burmese society, and I think that can be a great thing. And I think if the Burmese people play it right, they can benefit from the creativity and prosperity of both these countries. But I think for them to be able to engage in both these countries in the best way possible for the Burmese people and not wind up second-class citizens producing raw material and supplying cheap labor to both of these economies, they need to change quite quickly. And they need the right kinds of investment in terms of health and education and all these other things. But they also need this vital link with the West. I really think that this link with the West, with Europe, with America, is the added thing which is going to make it able for them to be able to engage economically in other ways with China and India in a way which doesn't make them wind up second-class citizens in the region.
I think near the beginning of the conversation, you noted the fact that probably if people know anything about Burma, they will recognize the name of Aung San Suu Kyi, who was the leader of the democratic opposition in the country, and who since probably over the last, I don't know, 15 years or something, has spent probably most of that time under house arrest. In spite of and a lot of people feeling that her party won elections in 1990 and having received a Nobel Prize and so forth, do you think that over the short run here, there's really any possibility of things changing to the point where she actually could have some kind of role in government?
It's not impossible, because I think what's clear is that she still has an enormous following in the country. This was clear when she traveled around the last time she was free a few years ago and spoke to huge crowds of people in many parts of the country. And I think it's possible that some of the generals in the country can see her as someone who they can talk to, reconcile with, and perhaps lead the country together in some way. I think it's possible. I think it's extremely unlikely, though, because of the history of the last 15 years. I mean, there have been attempts by her and by the government to talk to each other. There were attempted negotiations as late as 2 years ago, which then fell apart. I think from the military's point of view, what's important to remember is that she is an opposition leader who they feel they can deal with, or who they have already marginalized, however much international support and even domestic support she has. For them, in a way, the more important opposition leaders to deal with are the ones who have arms. These groups, some as two, three times as big as the Taliban in Afghanistan, like the United Wa Army in the east of the country, who have, you know, 20, 25,000 fighters, some are much smaller, but some are as big as that, who they are trying to do deals with and agree on some autonomy arrangements. So in a way, for them, it's two different oppositions. And as military men, they kind of respect and or at least feel they need to deal more with the first, the armed opposition groups, and they feel they can actually marginalize and keep Aung San Suu Kyi very easily in check, whatever her foreign support. So I think it's not impossible, but it's unlikely. And one just last point on that, which is that we talk about the generals, but you know, General Ne Win is gone. He died a few years ago, and he more or less left public life about 10, 15 years ago. And you have to think of the military guys not just as, you know, one guy at the top or a single tyrant. It is a machine. It is a bureaucracy where people get promoted, where people retire at 60, where people go in, you know, they go into the Defense Academy, get jobs, they get promoted up depending on who they know, but also on how well they perform. It is a whole system. And it's a system which has evolved in complete isolation from the rest of the world. And it's a system which has evolved with its own peculiar mentality. They themselves think they are doing the right thing for the country. And that's why I think, you know, whatever fresh air can be provided from the outside to start changing thinking in the country in general is extremely needed. And I think without that, the idea that somehow they'll wake up and say, yes, we need to talk to Aung San Suu Kyi and have a democracy, I think is wishful thinking. Mm.
For someone like you, I think perhaps you see at this point what the main thing that you can do is to write books and to write op-ed pieces and to do radio interviews and to do as much as you can to talk about Burma. Would you like to have a more direct role? Do you see some kind of direct role in changing Burma if you had the opportunity to do that?
If things changed inside the country and there was a real meaningful movement forward on the political front and in other ways, there was an opening up, the human rights situation improved at least a bit. I mean, I'm not necessarily a fully democratic system, but something that was better than this, and there was opportunities to, in a meaningful way, for me to go back and do something. I don't want to be involved in politics, and I wouldn't want any kind of, you know, official position, but to set up an NGO or to teach at the university or something like that, I'd be happy to help out in some way. But beyond that, I don't have any specific ambitions in terms of doing anything in Burma per se.
No, so you couldn't see yourself in being involved in government. That just wouldn't be what you would.
No, I've never thought of that really, and it's so far from what is possible today. So it's not something I've thought about. Whereas I think I hopefully can play some role in informing people about, you know, I don't have any exactly clear ideas in terms of exactly what foreign policy is needed towards Burma today, but I think what's important for me is for people to have a sense of the history, the complexity of it, and to know that at the root of so many of the problems is not just the dictatorship, the poverty, the war, but the isolation that the military has created, and that's the thing that sustains them in many ways.
Mm-hmm. I guess I wonder if still there wouldn't still be a large challenge of trying to take a country where there are different ethnic groups, there are different political groups, there are people who would be willing to use armed force to get what they wanted, and to get all of those kinds of people together at the table. And as the difficulty, I think, there would be as the difficulty in a lot of other places of getting people to transcend whatever kind of individual loyalties they have and get a hold of some kind of an idea that there is something called Burma, and that no matter what people are ethnically, that they have a connection to, and maybe we should make a commitment to some kind of unified country.
I think the sad thing is that I think, you know, in a way, there might have been an opportunity for that 12, 14 years ago when the ceasefires were first agreed, but when many of these armed groups were still very well organized and in a way a threat to the government. When Aung San Suu Kyi was had first organized and the elections had just been held and it was a lot of momentum behind her and her party, I think if there had been very creative diplomacy from the outside, whether from the UN or from the US or from a coalition of different countries that were concerned, if people had taken up the government on its desire to move towards a more open economy and started investing in the country as a way of gaining leverage as well over the government, I think, you know, some kind of diplomatic solution that would have gotten the government to talk to all the groups in a meaningful way might have been possible. I think 10, 15 years on today, the government's been very successful at slowly grinding down a lot of the armed opposition groups. They've had ceasefires, but they've done the exact opposite of what the West has done to the government through sanctions. Rather than imposing sanctions on these armed opponents, they've actually encouraged them to do business. They've encouraged them to invest in real estate in Rangoon. They've encouraged them to send their kids abroad to school, to the extent that these groups are no longer, many of them, are no longer viable military threats. And they've managed to marginalize Aung San Suu Kyi as well. So I think the military, in a way, are in a much in their own mentality and in their own viewpoint, they're in a much less susceptible position to the arguments that they need to talk to anyone at this point. Because the other side of that, and my last point, is that they are very much in this bunker mentality. Because they understand so little about the outside world, when they hear that the U.S. government labels them an outpost of tyranny, when they're mentioned in the same breath as Iraq and Iran and North Korea, they really think that the U.S. might invade them tomorrow. And so much, as military guys who've been in the military since they were 17, everything is about security and the army. And they are not in a position, in a way, to imagine what a different Burma could look like right now.
How, just as a way, I hate to end on such a negative note, but as a way of wrapping up, how is it possible to maintain any kind of optimism about the possibility of change?
Well, it's difficult because I think in a way, you know, on the one hand, the country is changing in so many ways. It's a very young country. Half the population is 18 or younger culturally. I mean, there's so much that actually happens. We've just talked about the politics, but there's so much happening in the cultural life of the country, the religious life of the country that's independent completely of the military. So things are changing. But, you know, I think in the end, if we reverse course in a way and have a fresh approach to Burma and try to find ways, ethical ways of engaging with the country through trade and investment and tourism, I think, you know, it's not impossible. I think it's possible a new generation of army people are coming up. It's not impossible that they will have different views, but I think we have to create a different international environment for them rather than the one that exists today.
Well, at that, we'll have to finish. It's a very interesting book, and if people are interested in getting some more knowledge, basic working knowledge of Burma and its modern history, they should look for this book, The River of Lost Footsteps, Histories of Burma. That is the title. It's published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux by our guest, Tant Minh Thu. Dr. Tant, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.